Good afternoon and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg and we are live for an hour each weekday afternoon. We take your calls if you have questions about the Bible or about the Christian faith. And you can call if you have a difference of agreement, disagreement with the host. I'm a little out of breath because I just ran up the stairs and put on my headset just as the music was coming to an end. I was out of town this morning and had gauged my return to the studio by the assumption that the traffic was going to be moving. And I got caught in traffic that was almost totally stopped. And I called the studio to let them know that I would be maybe a minute or two late. And I was watching the clock as we were getting home. We finally got off the freeway, and I got in the door just probably as the theme music began to play. So I had to hook up my equipment and just made it, just barely. And so we're on the air, we're live, and we're ready to take your calls. The number to call is 844-484-5737. That's 844-484-5737. Our first caller today is Christopher from Miami, Florida. Christopher, welcome to the Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Thank you, Mr. Gregg. In one of your lectures, you said that you do not believe that the scriptures were written in a trance-like state, and you brought up an example where Paul had forgotten something,
yeah,
and then he corrected himself a few verses later.
Yeah.
Do you remember that?
Yes.
Okay. Well, my question is, using that logic, do you think maybe God allowed man to describe the earth as being flat in a terrarium with a dome and all that? Because maybe just it wasn't important? Or what do you think about that whole flat earth thing? Thank you.
Oh, sure. Well, I don't believe that I don't think the Bible does say the earth is flat. So, if it did say the earth was flat, we'd have to ask why it said that and, you know, whether the people who said it were making a mistake or whether, you know, God was, whether it was using figurative language or whatever. But I'm not aware of any place in the Bible that actually says the earth is flat. So I'm not stuck with that. I do believe, though, that there are ways of speaking in the Bible that are not scientifically accurate, not because they're inaccurate, but because they're making no attempt at making a scientific statement at all. And so, you know, a lot of times they do write in the terms that they would speak in ancient times because they did live in ancient times. The writers were ancient people. And insofar as God didn't reveal scientific information to them, they certainly cannot be expected to have been knowledgeable about things that were not known scientifically at the time. Some people ask me if I think the biblical writers thought the earth was flat. Well, I don't know if they thought it was or not. They didn't say so. If they said so, then we'd have to be concerned that they were not inspired writers, or we'd have to have some other explanation. But whether they personally and privately thought the earth was flat or not, I don't know. I mean, certainly a man can have all kinds of private opinions and not affect the thing he writes as a prophet of God, because prophets of God are not omniscient. They only write what God reveals to them. And if God didn't talk to them about the shape of the earth, they might have held private opinions about it being flat. I don't know if they did or not. It's not necessarily the case that all ancient people believed in a flat earth. Ptolemy, for example, believed that the earth was a little speck out in space, negligible in size, and so forth. And he was right in the first century or second century A.D., you know, what individual cultures thought about the earth, I don't know. I mean, I don't study that out. But the Bible doesn't say the earth is flat. Now, when it does talk about the corners of the earth or the pillars of the earth, it is using it. You'll find it always only in poetic passages. And poetry, as a rule, uses poetic language and non-literal language, metaphors, flowery imagery, and things like that. That's what poetry does. And that's what biblical poetry does, too. So if you find an expression, the pillars of the earth, in biblical poetry, that may or may not mean that the person who wrote it had any real belief that the earth stood upon pillars. I don't believe necessarily that we do have an example of error in the Bible when it comes to that particular matter of you know, the shape of the earth, because I don't think the Bible actually makes any statements about that. There's a lecture of mine in the series. I'm looking for it here. It's in the Authority of Scripture series about science and the Bible. And I give the example there of poetic language in Shelley's poem, The Cloud. Now, this is a modern poet talking about clouds. And he says, here's what the cloud says in his poem. I bind the sun's throne with a burning zone, and the moon with a girdle of pearl. The volcanoes are dim, and the stars reel and swim when whirlwinds my banner unfurl. Now, that's the boast of a cloud speaking. Now, I don't believe that Shelley, who is a modern poet, believed that the sun sat on a throne, or that it was bound with the, or the moon was bound with a girdle of pearl. I don't think he thought the stars reel and swim, or anything like that. But that's just poetic language, and English poets do that. Poets of all societies do that. That's just what poetry is. It's poetic. They have poetic license. And anyone who knows anything about the Old Testament knows that the vast majority of it, at least the parts that are not historical narrative, are written in poetry. Job, Psalms, Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, Song of Solomon, the prophets, they're all written in poetry. So it shouldn't be surprising if they say things that aren't exactly designed to explain reality in scientific terms. Poets don't usually have any interest in doing so. All right. Let's talk to Jay from Corvallis, Oregon. Jay, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Steve?
Yeah.
Yeah. I was just wondering if you could help me out. I'm just getting over pneumonia. I can barely talk, and I've had some stress in my life and trauma and anxiety and nervousness and stuff. If you could give me some verses or chapters that would be really beneficial, I'd appreciate that, and I'll just
about,
take it off the air.
Well,
okay?
Well, we talk about chapters or verses about stress or pneumonia or about what?
Well, about all the trouble that I've been going through the last 3 months. I got really sick, and my wife got really sick, and I'm just going through a total bunch of anxiety and stress, trauma, and just nervousness, and I just wonder if you could give me some assurance and some comfort verses or chapters or what would be good to read. I'd appreciate it.
Okay. Well,
I'll take it off the air, okay?
Okay, sure.
Thank you very much, Steve. I appreciate your program.
All right. Thank you, Jay. Well, listen, they say you can't just hand out Bible verses like aspirin. And that's true. Bible verses, once in a while, a given Bible verse will say something that really hits the spot and awakens you to a truth that sets you free. It is, in fact, the truth that sets you free, and it's an apprehension of that truth rather than knowing a particular chapter or Bible verse that sets you free. I've certainly been through times of great trouble on occasion, and I have found that reading the Psalms out loud have been a tremendous help to me. In fact, reading them out loud as prayers is what I would recommend, because the Psalms are mostly written, not all of them, but a lot of them are written by David or someone else who is in great trouble at the time. The book of Job also was helpful to me. I remember reading through the book of Job in a sitting, which is a long book, at one time when I was going through some serious trials. It was very helpful to me. The teachings of Jesus are helpful in Matthew chapter 6, especially when he says not to have anxiety, not to be anxious about anything. And, of course, the whole thing here is that it's not a matter of having verses merely. It's a matter of having faith in God. And certain verses remind us to have faith in God. Perhaps other verses will give us reasons to have faith in God. But faith in God is something that we have to really just adopt as a mindset. And the more we are able to trust God, the less there is about the world's stresses that can really agitate us. So, I could recommend some of those passages, like I said. For me, when my, in the times of greatest trial, to me, reading the Psalms out loud as prayers have always been the most helpful thing. Now, but that's partly because I do have a relationship with God that those psalms tend to express well, because I can relate with David. I can relate with his trust in God. I can relate with his trials and things like that in many cases. If you can't relate with them, if you don't have trust in God, then it's another matter. But I think you probably do, which is probably why you're calling. And so I would just look to the psalms, and you might say, well, which ones are best? Really, they're all mixed together. They change from subject to subject as you read from one psalm to the next. But there's a if you read five psalms in a row, and that's not too hard to do, you'll find two of them, or three at least, that speak to you in the place of stress, the place of worry, and the place of trial, and so forth. So let me recommend that if I could. Also the book of Job, as I said, and also, of course, the teachings of Jesus in the Sermon on the Mount, especially chapter 6 of Matthew. And there's a lot in the, frankly, a lot in the epistles too. But I really, to single out one passage or two or three passages, I don't know. I don't know if that's as good as just kind of saturating yourself in the thought and the mentality of the psalmist when he's in trials and how he speaks to his soul. He says, why are you cast down within me, O my soul? Trust in God, hope in God, and a lot of times you have to just take control of your soul. You have to speak to your emotions and say, hey, trust in God, stop being so worried. And that's what David often does. In fact, in many of the Psalms, I would say the majority of the Psalms, they begin with the writer complaining that things are going badly, complaining that things went bad for the nation of Israel, or they've gone bad for him personally, or he's got a lot of enemies or whatever. And he describes his problem, and he kind of pours out his complaint, we could say. But then by the end of the psalm, in most cases, with very few exceptions, he's now clear. He's now praising God and expressing his faith and trust and confidence in God in the matter. And the psalm itself is a prayer that seems to release that burden for him. So that by the time he's done, though he started out complaining, he ends up praising. And I think that's one of the great values of reading the Psalms out loud. That you do, if you do go through a lot of trials, you do connect with them emotionally. You know, when I was young and I hadn't really been through very many trials, I never had much sympathy for people who said they loved the Psalms so much. I mean, I didn't dislike them, but I just didn't find them to be speaking to me in a place that I needed to be spoken to. And then after I lived a while, got older, went through some trials, those psalms became the most relevant of all the passages in the Bible and for certain seasons. So let me just recommend the psalms to you in this, and that you, again, not just read them out loud as prayers, offer them up as prayers to God. I think they will help, at least many of them certainly will be of great use to you. Marie from Riverside, California, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi there. I wanted to know about 1 Corinthians 15:29. It's baptism for the dead.
Yeah, well, I mean, a lot of us would like to know about that. Paul doesn't explain what he means when he says, why are they baptized for the dead? If the dead don't rise at all, why are they then baptized for the dead? Do you know there are more than 40 interpretations of that verse that can be found in commentaries? Now, I haven't found 40, but one commentary I read said he had found 40 different interpretations given by different commentators, and I myself have found a great number of them, too. So the problem here is that Paul is writing to the Corinthians about something they know about. They know what he's talking about. And this is the problem we sometimes have when we're reading the epistles. We're reading somebody else's mail. And as we're reading somebody else's mail, it is written in the context of a relationship where the receiver and the sender of the mail have some shared knowledge and some shared experience, and they can allude to things, and they understand each other. And that's the case in Paul's letters. Now, only rarely do you have Paul make a statement like this, which we just really don't know what he might be talking about. But he does talk about people being baptized for the dead. Now, there's two ways of going on this. He's either approving of the practice or he's not approving of the practice. He doesn't say he approves of the practice, but he says some people were doing it. He said, what shall they do who are baptized for the dead if the dead don't rise at all? Why then are they baptized for the dead? Well, it's a practice he was aware of, and it was a practice which he said was inconsistent if there was not a corresponding belief in the resurrection of the dead. Now, some people believe that Paul was against the practice, whatever it was, that he was aware of some groups, maybe some cults, that baptized dead people in place of living people. The Mormons do this, for example. Uh-huh. And that Paul might have known some groups that did that kind of thing, and he wasn't favorable toward it, but apparently they were also, the same groups were denying the resurrection of the dead. And he's saying, well, how inconsistent is that? If there's no resurrection of the dead, why baptize for the dead? And that he was not saying that baptizing for the dead was a good thing, but only an inconsistent thing for people who did it if they didn't believe in the resurrection of the dead. Now, the other possibility is that Paul spoke of it as something he did approve of. But it's not likely that he approved of baptizing dead people, or I should say living people, on behalf of dead people. But there is a possibility that he's talking about Christian baptism when he talks being baptized for the dead. Because Jesus would be dead. If the dead don't rise at all, Jesus hasn't risen. And then Jesus would be dead. Why would people be baptized in the name of Jesus, who would be, in fact, dead if the dead don't rise? Now, he has actually said that very thing back in verse 13. He says, if there is no resurrection of the dead, then Christ is not risen. In 1 Corinthians 15:13. Now, there's also in verse 29, if the dead do not rise at all. So both verse 13 and 29 both have this statement. If there's no resurrection of the dead, or if the dead do not rise at all, okay, well then, in verse 13 it says, if the dead don't rise, then Jesus isn't risen. That means Jesus is dead. And why would we be baptized in the name of Jesus, who is dead, if the dead don't rise at all? He would be saying that Christians who are in fact baptized in the name of Christ, which is the right way to be baptized, are doing something that doesn't make much sense. If he's dead, why be baptized in his name? If the dead don't rise at all, he's dead, and therefore don't do it. So, but he's arguing that there is a resurrection from the dead, and that being baptized in the name of Jesus is not being baptized for a dead person at all. But, as I said, there are quite a lot of interpretations available of this verse. And you know, I'm of the view, at least tentatively, that this last position I mentioned is possibly true. That he's saying, if the dead don't rise, then Jesus is dead. Why be baptized for the dead? Mm-hmm. That is, for Jesus.
Okay. That makes a little more sense. I appreciate it so much.
All right.
And I love listening to you. Thank you so much.
All right, Marie, I appreciate you calling. God bless you.
God bless you. Bye.
Bye now. All right, our next caller is Alex from Phoenix, Arizona, and I need to let you know we have a line or two open now if you're interested in calling. You're listening to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg. You can reach me here at 844-484-5737. That's 844-484-5737. Alex, welcome to the Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Thank you for taking my call, Steve. My call today was about the actual time of the earth. It says that Adam and Eve was born, and then Cain and Abel came along, and so on and so on. But today you hear scientists talk about dinosaurs that are millions of years old. They actually contradict the Bible. And you think these dinosaurs just actually walked the earth, but the scientist is wrong, or they're just, from an atheist point of view, are just saying that to contradict the Bible? Because I've read in the Old Testament where it says that there was sea creatures and different types of large animals, I guess you could say, that walked the earth during those times, probably with Abraham and stuff like that. And it's just... extinct, but they're only extinct for maybe 5,000 years instead of 50 million years. Because if you believe in the Bible, Adam and Eve, to today's date, would only correspond with maybe 8 or 10,000 years or whatever it might be. So that's just going back 50 to 100 million years ago.
I hear you. Okay. I got you. I got your question. Okay, so yes. there's tension here between what the Bible seems to say about the time of Adam and Eve's creation, which, if you trace back the genealogies, and the years that people lived in each generation and so forth, it seems that they were created about 4004 BC. Yet, it looks like they were created on the sixth day of the world, which means that if they were created in 4004 BC, so was the world. And the animals and all that stuff were created 4004 BC. Now, there's a lot of ways that people deal with this. There are definitely Christians who believe that 4004 is the literal date that Adam and Eve were created, and that the earth isn't any older than that. There are others who think the earth is older than that, but Adam and Eve weren't created until then, and that the 6 days of creation prior to the creation of Adam and Eve are, they would take them as something other than literal days. And therefore the earth would think much older than Adam and Eve were. But Adam and Eve only came along a few thousand years ago, they would say. Others believe that the genealogies by which we arrive at the date of the creation of Adam and Eve are incomplete, that they leave out generations, and therefore they would say it's longer than 4,000 years before Christ that Adam and Eve were created. So there's a lot of ways that people do this. All I can say is, if the problem is with the dinosaurs, I would say there's, in my understanding, there's no absolute proof that dinosaurs died off 70 million years ago. Those who say that they did are people who are, they're using certain absence of data, really more than data. They say that there's no dinosaur bones found in the same strata with human beings, or even anywhere near the time that human being bones are found. This is assuming certain things about strata and the age of strata in the earth, assumptions that not everyone makes and not everyone has to make. One thing I would say, regardless of what the, what the scientists, how they interpret things about the dinosaur bones and human bones and so forth, we do have descriptions of dinosaurs in ancient literature. Every society, or at least people on every continent, have left records, some of them carved images and cave drawings, and some of them literary records, descriptions of creatures that if we saw those creatures today, we would call them dinosaurs. Of course, the word dinosaur didn't exist until the 1800s. So, the ancient people didn't call them dinosaurs. They called them dragons or something else. And that being so, it seems to me that we couldn't argue for sure that dinosaurs died off before people were here. Most important of all, I think, is the description of Behemoth and Leviathan in the book of Job. If you read Job chapter 40, beginning with verse 15, and then read on through chapter 41, that is the end of Job 40 and all of 41, you will find descriptions of two animals that are given names that are not recognizable to us, but they are huge. They are apparently reptilian. They have scales. They can go on land or sea, so they would be, in terms of their the environmental niche that they, ecological niche that they occupy, be something like crocodiles do. And they sound like they could be like crocodiles, except they're way too big. And their skin is way too thick. Spears can't pierce their scales. That's not true of crocodiles, by the way, but it is true of the Leviathan and Behemoth and so forth. And you can read these descriptions and say, if these descriptions are to be trusted, then they are describing what we would call a dinosaur. And that would mean Job, in his day, had seen them. God is speaking about them as a creature that Job could observe. In fact, he says in verse 15, Job 40, verse 15, look now at Behemoth. Okay? Take a look at Behemoth. Before that, God is talking to him about mountain goats and horses and eagles and other well-known animals. And he then mentions Behemoth and Leviathan. And he mentions them, as it were, in the same way that he mentions horses and mountain goats, as if they are known, familiar animals. So I believe they were. I believe there were dinosaurs, what we would call dinosaurs, alongside man. And I think historical records like Job have left us a record of that fact. Listen, we need to take a break because some of our stations are leaving our network right now. We are going on for another half hour on most stations. If you'd like to hear the whole program and can't hear it on your radio station, go to our website, thenarrowpath.com, and you can listen to it there. The Narrow Path is a listener-supported ministry. You can write to us at The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 1730, Temecula, California, 92593. And if you write to us and if you send a donation, you'll help us pay the radio bills. That's what we use the money for. You can also donate from the website, which is thenarrowpath.com, where you can also get the app for your phone, thenarrowpath.com. All resources there are free, and I hope you'll make use of them.
You are listening to The Narrow Path with Steve Gregg. The Narrow Path is listener-supported radio. After the show, we invite you to visit thenarrowpath.com to learn more. There are topical audio teachings, blog articles, verse-by-verse teachings, and the radio archives of all our shows. So when the show is over, come on over to thenarrowpath.com. Learn, study, enjoy. We thank you for your support, and we thank you for listening each day to The Narrow Path. We now return you to The Narrow Path with Steve Gregg.
Welcome back to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg. We are taking calls about the Bible. If you have questions about the Bible or the Christian faith, you can call. Right now, our lines are full, but they will be. Some of them will be opening up in the next half hour, and you can call through at this number if you have it ready at hand. The number is 844-484-5737. That's 844-484-5737. And, you know, you can call if you have a disagreement with host, too. I mean, some of the things we say here are things that not all Christians agree with, and certainly many things that, you know, non-Christians don't believe in. But you're welcome to call, whether you're a Christian or not a Christian, and whether you disagree with something that the host says, you're always welcome to bring it up for conversation. 844-484-5737 is the number. Our next caller is Rod from Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Hi, Rod. Welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hey, thanks a lot. I actually may have a disagreement with my pastor. He gave a sermon the other week, and I respect him a lot. He gave a sermon, and what he said was that he prefaced it by saying, we all know that the Bible says that a man and woman should not live together before they get married. And I was kind of like, okay. I mean, I'm not quite sure where that is. That was my first question, and the second question kind of goes along with that. If you could kind of lay out for me the biblical paradigm for marriage vis-a-vis what we do, you know, where we have the ceremonies and then you have to have a bunch of people around and a state-issued license and so forth. Because we have a young couple in our church. They're going to get married. The guy's from the West Coast, and they've been kind of coming back and visiting each other back and forth. And they're planning on getting married. So he comes, and I'm sure they're staying together. And they're going to be getting married in the next month or two, and I'm sure there's some people talking about whether or not they're, quote-unquote, living in sin. So what's really the big deal? I mean, at the end of the day, we make a vow before God, and we're accountable to God. So why are we accountable to witnesses, and why is our paradigm what it is now as compared to what the true biblical paradigm is?
All right. Well, first of all, the Bible doesn't come right out and say it's wrong for a man and a woman to live together unmarried, but it does indicate it's wrong for them to sleep together, to have sex together unmarried. And if you're not going to have sex together and you're attracted to each other, living together is a situation that, first of all, is dangerous and, secondly, looks bad. Even if you're behaving, people outside the home don't know that, and therefore it can hurt your testimony. Technically, for a man and woman to sleep under the same roof is, of course, not a sin. But it's sex outside of marriage that is an abuse of sex. Now, what is marriage then? This couple you described are planning to get married, but they apparently haven't gotten married yet. Now, what is marriage? Well, in the Bible, it doesn't really have much to do with a ceremony, though I'm in favor of marriage ceremonies, but for reasons I'll give you. But the Bible doesn't really tell us anything about a marriage ceremony, except, of course, some of the parables of Jesus are set in the context of a wedding, and Jesus attended a wedding, but that doesn't mean that he was teaching anything about the need for ceremonies. He did attend weddings as they existed, and he used wedding feast as a parable setting. But the Bible doesn't really tell us what weddings must be like or what must be included. But the Bible does indicate that marriage is a covenant, and that covenant is entered with vows. And that's why wedding ceremonies include vows, because that's probably the essential part of getting married. If a man and woman want to start a family for life, and they state their intentions with vows, this is really what makes it a marriage. But, of course, the question arises, what if they do this, you know, more or less privately? Well, why would they do that? Why would they do that? Why would they do it privately? They're planning to live together and start a family. Don't they want people to hear know they're married? I mean, the whole thing is that marriage is not just a private matter between a man and a woman. It's a societal matter. And society has an interest in marriage as an institution. And if people are living together and they have secretly taken vows together, but no one else knows it, well, why? Why don't they want other people to know it? Don't they want to be held accountable? The purpose of a public wedding, and as far as I know, no society has really considered normative marriage to be without public knowledge of it, because it's a public institution. You become part of a new social unit in society, and society has an interest in your marriage and in your children. What you do affects other people, not just your own family. And that being so, in the church especially, I think it's very valuable to have people who you're in fellowship with witness your vows. Now, in the Bible, in the earliest days, like Abraham's day and so forth, weddings probably were just family. Probably just the parents of the bride and the parents of the groom and whatever siblings were there attended and made sure the vows were made and that there was, faith was pledged and so forth. But the main thing is that there should be witnesses, because vows are easy to break if no one has heard them, if they're secret. And frankly, many people who get married, after they find it very difficult, would like to actually get out. And we see that, of course, by the huge divorce rate. We can see that people who mean very well when they get married, I'm sure virtually everyone who gets divorced, maybe with some exceptions, but almost everyone who gets divorced thought they were going to be married for life and pledged to be, which means, people can make a mistake. But the pledge and the vow is to keep you honest once you decide that maybe you made a mistake. Because if you make a mistake, you still have to live with it. You have to keep your promises. And if no one else has heard you make those promises, then when the husband and wife decide marriage is a little hard for them and they say, well, why don't we just get out of it? Then they, then they do. No one holds them accountable. But the church has an interest in it. Yeah, they are accountable to God. But it's amazing how many people, make excuses for that when they decide that marriage is a hard thing to be in. Now, are you a married man yourself?
I am. I've been married for 13 years.
And, yeah, so.
I went through the standard way, but I was just questioning, what is the biblical paradigm? Otherwise, it's legalism. If we just kind of say we think it should be this way because it makes sense and because that's how we do it, I get that. But I'm just saying, if these two, they love each other, a couple of their family members get together and they exchange vows and just go ahead. I'm just saying, what is it? What is the, how are we going against God? Because ultimately, like I said, we're accountable to God.
Well, yeah, but we're accountable to the body of Christ, too, in our moral life, because, frankly, the body of Christ has the power and the obligation to discipline immoral behavior in its members. So the body of Christ is a family, and it has a vested interest in the holiness of its members. And the Bible makes it very clear, both Jesus and Paul make it very clear, that if a member of the church is living in immorality, then the church has got to take it up as a matter of discipline. Now, of course, for the church to even know whether it's immorality or not, they need to know whether vows were taken or not, whether they're married or not. And it presupposes, of course, that the church is in on this. Now, what I wonder is, you might say, well, it's legalism to add more things than the Bible actually says. Well, sometimes that is true. But going the other way, I think, why would they not want to make a public saying of vows? I mean, what is it about their commitment or lack thereof that they don't want everyone to know they're making this commitment? I mean, in other words, it may be that a wedding before a judge with two witnesses would be enough to be a real wedding. But if you've got the choice between that and being married before your family and friends and having them witness your vows, why would you not want them to?
Agreed.
You know, whenever someone says, well, we did this privately, I say, well, why don't you do it publicly? Well, we don't have to. Well, I didn't ask about have to. Why wouldn't you want to? Is this vow something you really mean? Or is it something you're hoping maybe if it goes wrong, you'll get out of it? And the less people know about it, the better. When I got married, I wanted everyone in the world to know that I was getting married. And because I want everyone in the world to hold me accountable for my vows. And not that I would break them otherwise, but I mean, anyone could be tempted. But the thing is that when you make your vows in front of people, the people who watch it become responsible to hold your feet to the fire when you start waffling in your commitment. So, I mean, no, the Bible doesn't say it has to be done in public, though the Bible doesn't know of any weddings that weren't public. You know, I mean, I guess that'd be the point. What's commanded and what's just taken for granted are two different categories. But it may be that if things weren't already taken for granted, then there would be a command about it. But you don't have to command that, which is universally done. The real question is, in principle, why are weddings public? And in principle, it is because the formation of a new family unit is a matter of legitimate concern to the social group that the people belong to. And if it's the church, especially so.
I mean, I hear you. I mean, I hear what you're saying. And in principle, it makes sense. But I'm just saying, you know, would this young couple be guilty of fornication if they're exclusive right now? Again, they're on the route of getting married very soon, and they're committed to one another already in their hearts. If they're having a sexual relationship now, is that biblically committing fornication?
Well, the Bible doesn't define fornication quite that narrowly. What the Bible indicates is if people do commit a sexual act before they're married, then they are required to get married, of course. Now, you might say, well, no problem. These people are planning to. But planning to isn't the same thing as doing it. I've known a lot of people who've planned to get married and didn't get married. And some of them didn't right at the last minute. Some people were planning to right up until the day of the wedding, and then they bailed at the time of the wedding. In other words, that people say, we love each other. Okay, well, I've loved a lot of people. I haven't married them all, and we plan to get married. Well, there's been people I thought I might marry that I didn't marry, but there was one case of a woman I was in a relationship with for years, and we did plan to get married. I thought it was decided. And she bailed after a while. So you never know until it happens. Until those vows have been taken, you don't know that they're going to get married. Even they don't know they will because they think they will. But then when people are in love, they are in the least rational state to make predictions about how they're going to feel in the future or what they're going to do in the future. So, what's the problem? Why can't they abstain? Why can't they abstain until they get married? Love is self-controlled. Love is patient. If they're in love with each other, can they be patient?
Right on. I hear you. I can't argue with you. I mean, I think it's what you're saying makes sense. But I'm just saying that, you know, by the letter, you know, and again, if they're going to get married anyway, now if they failed, now they're guilty of fornication. And so, again, so they're guilty to God for breaking, you know, one of God's laws. But if they're having sexual relations and they do get married in the next 1 or 2 months, then they're fine. And they were really, you see what I'm saying?
I would just ask them the question I mentioned. Why can't you wait? Don't you have self-control? Don't you have patience? Then you don't have love, right? Love is patient. So you say you're in love, but maybe you're in lust. And people in lust do not have a real strong foundation for marriage, at least for a lasting marriage, because lust very rarely hangs on with the same kind of tenacity in a relationship that it has in the courting period. But, you know, if they can't wait till two months, why don't they get married today?
Well, they can. They may not have a big wedding feast, you know, a big wedding ceremony.
Okay, they don't have to have a big wedding, but I believe it should. I think there should be witnesses.
Right, right. Yeah, I mean, I hear you. That's a good point. I mean, I can't argue against you.
All right. Well, hey, I got my lines full, so I should take another caller, Rod, but it's good to talk to you.
Thank you so much, brother. Thank you.
All right. God bless you. Thanks for calling. We're going to take some more calls before we run out of time here. Eric from Washington, I believe that's Washington State. Welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hey, good afternoon. How are you today?
Good.
Great. Well, I just wanted to say thank you so much for your wisdom and knowledge on these topics. You know, what a great lesson, and I'm kind of new to all this, so I hope my question isn't too basic for you, but we'll see how it goes. I wanted to ask you, I'm new to reading the Bible, and I was talking to some friends, and they were saying that there are books that are left out of the Bible. And I just wanted to ask you if this is true. They were specifically saying Thomas wrote and Mary Magdalene wrote, and those books were specifically left out of the Bible. And if so, why? And what is contained in those books that they were left out?
All right.
I also wanted to ask you another thing about what constitutes a change to the Bible. How does it change with the times, et cetera, you know? So I just was looking for some confirmation and some further detail, and who better to ask than you?
Well, there may be better people to ask than me, but I'll be glad to give an answer.
Well, thank you so much. I'll take the answer off air, so thank you so much.
All right, sure. On the matter of people, books being left out of the Bible, you know, there are millions of books that are written, and all of them were left out of the Bible, except for 66 books that are in the Bible. That means there are hundreds of thousands, if not millions. Well, there must be millions of books. I think Amazon.com has a million books. None of them are in the Bible, except for the Bibles that they sell. So lots of books are left out of the Bible. The real question is, why are books included in the Bible? The Bible is a collection of 66 special books. The question is, what constitutes that specialness? In the Old Testament, the Jews who collected the Old Testament books collect them on the basis of them believing that they were inspired by God. And that would mean that the writers were prophets, that they were written by prophets. Now, most books are not written by prophets. There's a million books at Amazon.com, but none of them are written by prophets, probably. Okay, so that would eliminate most books there. In the New Testament, the books were written by apostles or companions of the apostles. And that, again, would eliminate almost every other book, too. Almost no books written besides the ones in the Bible were ever written by apostles or companions of apostles. In fact, we don't know of any. Now, your friend mentioned that Thomas wrote a book and Mary Magdalene wrote a book, but there's no evidence that they actually did. There is a book called The Gospel According to Thomas, but Thomas certainly didn't write it. There's a book called The Gospel of Mary, and there's a Gospel of Philip and a Gospel of Peter and quite a few other Gospels and other books that were written in the 2nd and the 3rd century, long after the apostles were dead. These were the Gnostic Gospels that arose in the context of Gnosticism, which was a heresy that flourished in the 2nd and the 3rd century A.D. This was after the apostles were gone, and therefore Thomas didn't write the Gospel of Thomas, and Peter didn't write the Gospel of Peter, and Philip didn't write the Gospel of Philip, and Mary didn't write the Gospel of Mary. These were written by other people claiming to be them. And if there was no other reason to exclude them from the Bible, the very fact that they lied about who they were would be an excellent reason to exclude them from the Bible. If you've got somebody saying, I am Philip, but he's not, well, right there you've got, in the opening line, he's proved he's untrustworthy. Why would you put his book in the Bible? So, yeah, there are quite a few of what they're called the apocryphal Gospels or the Gnostic Gospels. These are products of the 2nd and 3rd century. They were written after the apostles were dead, and the writers, whoever they were anonymous, but they attached the names of famous apostles and famous Christians to them to give them a sense of artificial credibility. Now, the Gospels in the Bible are different. They were written in the 1st century, and the early church knew who wrote them. It's interesting, the writers of the Gospels in the New Testament wrote anonymously. The titles of our Gospels, the Gospel according to Matthew, Gospel according to Mark, were not on the originals. Those are added because that's what the early church remembered to be the authors of them. But the authors didn't claim to be anyone in particular, which sets them off from the Gnostic Gospels. They weren't pretending to be anyone. They were just telling a story that was true. It just so happens that the church that knew them and received these books from their hands knew who they were and preserved the memory of who they were. So we've got four Gospels written by apostles or close companions of apostles in the Bible. The books that were not included that call themselves Gospels were not written by apostles, and that's why they're not included. Now, you mentioned, you know, what constitutes a change in the Bible. Apparently, you're asking, you know, is the Bible like some people call the Constitution a living document? Is the Bible a living document that needs to change with the times? Not much. I mean, there are cultural things in the Bible from time to time, like greet one another with a holy kiss. That's not necessarily the only way to greet people in a godly way, but that's the way they did it back then. We could say greet each other with a hug or a handshake or something else, some other form of greeting. Everyone recognized that's simply a cultural thing. Likewise, when Paul talks about women covering their heads when they pray or prophesy, he says, we don't have this custom. This is for you Corinthians. We don't have this custom in other churches. So it's a cultural thing. There are some things in the Bible that are cultural that are instructed. And we have to recognize, well, they were legitimate to the original audience because that was their culture. But there are other things that reflect moral principle, and morals don't change. Why don't morals change? Because morals are defined by the character of God, and God doesn't change. Anything that's impure is contrary to the purity of God's character. Anything that's unfaithful is contrary to the faithfulness of God's character. Anything that is unjust is contrary to the justice of God's character. Anything that is unmerciful is contrary to the mercy and the compassion in God's character. In other words, whatever God is like is still what people are supposed to be like. And when you read the Bible and you read instructions given both in the Old and the New Testament, you can see almost immediately whether these instructions have something of an arbitrary cultural nature to them or whether they reflect something that's in the unchanging character of God. Do these instructions have to do with purity? Do they have to do with justice? Do they have to do with faithfulness? Do they have to do with mercy? If so, then they are the kinds of things that will never change. And certainly most of the instructions in the New Testament would be in that category. They would be permanently, legitimate. All right, our next caller is Diane from Temecula. Diane, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Thank you, Steve. I'll take my answer off the air as well. Actually, it's two if you have time. First one, they're both in the book of Daniel. First one is chapter 2. It says, one night in the second year of his reign, Nebuchadnezzar had a dream, and it culminates with him calling in Daniel. My question on that is that I thought that Nebuchadnezzar had been, you know, reigning for some time before he even brought the first load of captives back to Babylon, and then Daniel was in training for 3 years. So I'm wondering if you could explain that. And the second question is, when the statue was made and everyone was required to bow down to it by Nebuchadnezzar, why Daniel, if you have any idea why Daniel was not mentioned in that story, I'm sure he wouldn't have bowed, but he is not mentioned. So those are my two questions.
Okay, and good ones. Well, first of all, Nebuchadnezzar was a general under his father before he was himself the emperor of Babylon. And as a general, he had earlier attacked regions in the Middle East. He had taken captives in 605 BC, for example, which included Daniel and his companions. He also came back in 597 BC and took some more captives that included Ezekiel. And then in 586 BC, he came back and destroyed the city. But the first time he came, 605 BC, apparently is what's referred to as the first year of his reign. Now, you're right. Daniel and his companions, who were taken in the first year of Nebuchadnezzar's reign, were subjected to a three-year program of cultural training. Since they were Jews living in Babylon, they had to learn all the language and the ways of the Babylonians. And yet, it's in the second year of Nebuchadnezzar, apparently the next year, that Daniel is called in to interpret Nebuchadnezzar's dream, as you point out. We either have to assume that this brought an end to his training, or that it was in the midst of his training. That is, he was in a 3-year program of training, and in the, you know, at the end of the first year, he happened to be called upon to do some dream interpretation. But then after that, he either continued for another 2 years of training, or else it was discontinued. And to say that you know, they were trained for 3 years would mean perhaps that his friends and he were put into a 3-year program. Daniel may have gotten graduated early after interpreting Nebuchadnezzar's dream, but there's no reason to assume that that's true. He could have finished out the 3-year training, even though he interpreted Nebuchadnezzar's dream in the midst of that period of time. As far as Daniel's absence in chapter 3, when Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego refused to bow to the image that Nebuchadnezzar had built, it is often assumed that Daniel was perhaps out of town on the king's business. The Babylonian Empire covered a wide range of territory, and not everyone would be in one place, in the spot where that statue was, to bow down to it. There'd be, government officials all over the empire. And Daniel, it is assumed, must have been elsewhere, or else he too would have been standing up in defiance of this order, as Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego did. Daniel must have been carrying on some kind of the king's business somewhere else and was not subject to this particular order at this time. If he had been there, he would have been subject to it.
Okay, thank you, Steve. And 18 and 19 of chapter 1 would kind of be part of that, which you explained first, in that he was brought in after the 3-year training period. So,
yeah,
really good. Well, thank you. I appreciate it.
All right. Well, thanks for your call, Diane. Good talking to you. Bye now. Kristen from Bothell, Washington, we only have a minute or two. Can we help you in that time?
Yes, it's real quick.
Okay.
I was wondering if the fruits of the Spirit in Galatians is a complete list or not, because things like strength aren't mentioned, but I know elsewhere in the Bible we're called to be strong in the Lord. So I was wondering if there are other fruits of the Spirit that may not have been mentioned there.
Yes, there are many. Paul just gives 9 fruits of the Spirit in his list in Galatians 5:22 and 23. But there are other lists of similar qualities, which I'm sure he would call fruits of the Spirit also. He's not giving a complete list. He's giving an example of the kinds of fruit produced in a Christian's life. But throughout his epistles, he gives several different lists that include and overlap with the list of the fruits of the Spirit, but include some other ones. So, yes, I think your instincts are correct that there are other things besides those 9 things he mentions there that would be called fruits of the Spirit if Paul got around to calling them anything like that. You've been listening to The Narrow Path radio broadcast. As you may know, we're listener-supported. You can write to The Narrow Path at this address, P.O. Box 1730, Temecula, California, 92593. If you want to donate, you can do it that way, or you can go to our website, The Narrow Path. Thanks for joining us. Hope you have a great weekend. God bless you.